Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's entertaining and accessible. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host John Wells. Well, there are 20,000 cases of this disease reported annually, especially in the Southwest U.S., but an estimated 130,000 people have contracted it and go undiagnosed. What is it? It's Valley Fever. Today in the program, we'll speak with epidemiologist Tom Chiller of the Center for Disease Control. He'll talk about Valley Fever, now listed as an epidemic. He'll also talk about anything else interesting in the world of disease that we can get him to talk about. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Lynn. And then we're going to explore the world of hunches. Intuition? How about premonition? How accurate are we when we say we have a sixth sense? Is it real? Should we trust it? Can we train it? This is a question the U.S. Navy is dealing with, and we'll talk with Dr. Peter Squire, Program Officer for Human Performance, Training, and Education in the ONR, Office of Naval Research. He'll talk to us in the second half of the hour.
This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly starting at 5:30, also serving Sunday brunch from 9 to 1. The website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, we used to think that maybe fungus was pervasive only in those humid places, but we now know that certain fungi thrive in even the driest areas of the country, like those that cause valley fever. Valley fever affects as many as 150 people annually, especially in the areas of the Southwest, like Arizona, California, but it's also been found as high as Washington State. It's a fungus we inhale, and it directly affects our lungs, and often we don't even know we have it. But joining us now to talk about Valley Fever and other topics that an epidemiologist spends his day researching is Tom Chiller from the Center for Disease Control. And good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning, Lynn. Good morning, John. How are you guys?
We're great.
And doing real well. Thank
thanks
you.
For joining us. And, you know, I don't know where you're located. Where are you located in the country?
Yeah, so the CDC, our main campus is located here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, okay. All right, so you know nothing of this major dust storm that we had a couple nights ago in Utah. And we've seen these, especially in the spring, once or twice. Usually it's this bizarre thing that picks up all the dust from the West Desert and then sort of rains it down. And I started to think about this as I was reading about Valley Fever and the sort of proliferation of dust in our air. What's causing it? I guess that's my question. What's causing it?
What's causing the dust storms or what's causing Valley Fever?
Well, what's causing the proliferation of dust storms? I mean, I'm assuming it has to do with the lack of water in the West. But is this what is contributing to the dust that carries the spores that carry Valley Fever?
Well, I mean, certainly. And again, I'm not a dust storm expert in any way, shape, or form. But we do know that Valley Fever, which is also called coccidiomycosis, that's a mouthful, but it's called that because it's caused by the fungus coccidioides. And coccidioides is found in soils, as you mentioned, mainly desert sort of environments. And as you've already mentioned, Arizona and the Central Valley of California, where it gets its name, Valley Fever, are major areas where we see lots of infections. But it also is in other parts of the southwestern United States where there is this sort of desert environment. And as you mentioned, we can talk about maybe some of the newer areas where it may be found. But we know that large weather events like dust storms and even severe drought that can then cause more aerosolized dust are predisposed to an exposure to the soil, to the dust that carries the spores. And so clearly dust storms concern us for people being exposed to these spores and inhaling them and then potentially getting sick with valley fever.
Mm. And, you know, I think I asked you about the question about dust storms because I read there's a great article in The New Yorker. Maybe you've read it, by Dana Goodyear, who's been a guest on our show before. But she talks about this huge dust storm that, you know, kind of crops up around Bakersfield. It makes it as far north as like Sacramento, and then it starts raining down, which is exactly what happened the other day here. And of course, as we know, in the Central Valley, California, the lack of water and the water table going down will probably only give rise to this more and more, right?
Yeah. And again, I mean, I'm not a dust storm expert, but it certainly goes without saying that droughts predispose soil to being drier, which predisposes soil to being aerosolized. And, you know, this is a fungal organism that survives in soil for many years. We call it a spore. We've all heard of fungal spores. And, you know, unfortunately with valley fever, it really only takes one spore to potentially cause disease. And so what we are concerned about clearly is the fact that we're seeing more cases, at least more cases are being reported to us through health departments. As you already mentioned, I think we had over 20,000 reported in 2011, and we've seen sort of a steady increase over the past several years in the number of cases being reported. And that concerns us, and we're not sure if that has to do with whether that has to do with more people traveling to these areas where the spores exist, more people at risk for developing infection. I think the good news about valley fever is that a little under two-thirds of people that actually inhale the spores and get infected have absolutely no symptoms and never develop any disease. It's the one-third of people that do develop some disease, and then even a smaller proportion of those that go on to get disseminated or more severe disease that where we're concerned, obviously, and certainly those that have conditions that predispose them to diseases in general, like immunosuppressive conditions, we really worry about those people being exposed.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Chiller, you've got some great data. As I look at the study that you reported on in Arizona in 2007 in the beginning of 2008, of the 5,000 to 6,000 people in Arizona that had contracted and had been diagnosed with coccidiomycosis, valley fever, you all were able to interview 9% of those people. And what was interesting to me was as I read another article and talked about, well, you know, you get some flu symptoms and cough, cold, and that's kind of it, that 41% of those 9% interview were hospitalized and 75% missed work for, I believe, 2 weeks. That's quite a flu.
No, we know that there's, and I appreciate you bringing that up, and certainly it was enlightening to us as well to realize it's not so much the toll on the person with this disease when it's in its milder form, but it's the toll on society and the fact that it is a long flu. It does seem like it lasts for weeks, and people feel very fatigued and there is a tremendous amount of work loss, and you're absolutely right. There is a lot of hospitalization or visiting the doctors because you have this illness that just doesn't seem to go away. You know, it's one of those nagging illnesses that after a week you sort of feel like it should be resolving. It doesn't resolve. And so, yes, we did find that there is a pretty decent burden to society in general and obviously to the poor individuals that are diseased with it that it causes, and that's an important point.
And what is the relationship between a lowered immune system and contraction of coccidiomycosis?
Well, what we worry about in people who have lowered immune systems or are on medicines that suppress their immunity because, let's say, they had a transplant or they had a bone marrow transplant, or they might have cancer and they're receiving chemotherapy. All of these patients are at risk for lots of different infections, unfortunately, and valley fever is no exception. And so what happens is because the defenses are down and because our immune systems are not battling the good fight that they usually do, diseases like valley fever can disseminate much more readily and can cause much more severe disease in these individuals. And fungal diseases in general, and I'm a fungal disease person, so I've been studying these diseases for years, and they are very challenging to treat when you don't have good immune defenses yourself. So even with the best of antifungal medicines that we have available to us, they are still challenging when our own immune systems don't help out. So we really need our immune systems to kick in and help us fight these fungal infections, and valley fever is no exception.
Mm. You know, it's interesting that you say you're a fungal expert. A neighbor of mine is a pilot, travels all over the world, and he contracted some sort of fungal disease, and I was amazed to hear his story about trying to find the correct medication or antifungal medication to fight whatever this disease was. Now, I know if it's valley fever, you can identify it and possibly target it with one medication, but talk about the difficulty of finding the right medication for fungal diseases.
Yeah, in fungal diseases in general, we have a small, what I would say, armamentarium of medicines. We don't have a lot of different antifungal drugs, unlike with bacteria, with antibiotics that we think classically of treating a staph infection or a strep infection. We have a lot of choices, and we still have a lot of different antibiotics. But for antifungals, there's really only four major ones that we use. And there are different flavors of those four, and some of them act differently, have different side effects, may be better against one type of fungus or another. And so it does make it challenging if you don't know what you're treating. And so some of these fungi may be inherently resistant to the antifungal medicines we have, and we're left with very few choices, and that choice may be a drug that's very toxic, and therefore you're giving it to the patient, but you're concerned about toxicity. So yes, treating fungal diseases can be very challenging, and again, it really helps when our immune systems are working at full steam, because without that, these medicines may not be enough.
Mm. And the antifungal medications, as you say, they're so toxic and really hard on your, liver and kidneys, right?
They can be, depending on the medicine, Lynn. I mean, so some of them are more toxic toward the liver. Others can be toxic toward the kidney. I think when you're working with a physician who's treating these diseases, I think all of us are very good at managing these sorts of side effects and toxicities. These drugs have been around for a while, and I don't want to make it sound like these are, incredibly toxic drugs. I mean, we have people on a drug, for example, called fluconazole, very high doses for years and years, and they do fine. They do fantastic. So most of the time, people can take these drugs and do wonderfully well, but we do need to watch for toxicities like with any other drug we're using.
Dr. Chiller, I'm from Boston, and summertime in Boston is very humid. It's hot. We don't have our windows open all the time, or actually not that often. In Arizona, you do. It's drier. There's air conditioning, of course, that you need in the real hot days, but a lot of people have these open homes. When coccidiomycosis spores, or not, well, I think that's correct.
Yeah, spores. Yep.
When they blow through a house, can they take hold inside the house and reinfect the inhabitants?
Yeah, I mean, we generally don't think that these spores are, surviving in houses and cars and things like that for long periods of time, but they certainly get into indoor spaces, and, you know, they can get into air conditioning. I mean, they're in the air, and they're very, they drift in the air very, very easily. They're spread with dust and with, you know, wind very easily. So it's certainly a concern for anyone living in these endemic areas that they're breathing these spores in. And I think residents of Arizona and California and the Central Valley, you know about these diseases quite a bit. And many of them have already been exposed, as you can imagine. And I think the good news there is those people who have been exposed and had potentially an infection that was asymptomatic are probably not at risk to be reinfected. In other words, they develop their own immunity, and they are able to then to fight off further exposures that they have. And that's, it's almost like a self-vaccination of type.
Dr. Chiller, they're kind of like cockroaches, aren't they? I mean, they've been around well before humans hit the scene, and they'll probably certainly survive us after we destroy ourselves.
Well, fungi are certainly everywhere, John. Yeah. I mean, they're ubiquitous, right? They're in the environment. We breathe them in every day. Thankfully, most of them don't cause disease, like valley fever does. And thankfully, most of them don't cause disease in most of us anyway, because we have good immunity. So it's really our concern here is to make sure people are aware that these diseases exist, right? That they when they have symptoms, that they ask their doctor, what about valley fever if you're coming from an area that might have it? And so that, because it's, we can't avoid the contact with the fungus. It's very, very challenging, but we can try to diagnose it earlier and get on treatment earlier if that's what's needed.
I'm curious. I was kind of blown away when I learned recently that we have like two or three times more bacteria in our body than we do actual cells. And we have this kind of symbiotic relationship in a weird way with bacteria. Do we have the same type of thing with fungus?
Well, that's a great question. And I think we do with certain types of fungus. Candida, which I'm sure you've heard of, is a colonizer of our gastrointestinal tract, just like some of the bacteria you're talking about. I don't think we have a good handle on how much is there, like all these beneficial bacteria we have, but certainly we do have candida in our GI tracts. And then most of the other fungi, again, these fungi are environmental fungi. They don't want to be in our bodies or on our bodies. There's no advantage to them to do that, and they tend to be opportunistic when they infect us, because if they're on our skin and we inhale them, they tend just to pass through and don't cause any problems. So really, to my knowledge, candida is one of the ones that we know is in our gastrointestinal tract and probably does make up the milieu of those bacteria-fungal interactions that we have in our body.
Mm. Well, in addition to some of the other interesting things I'm learning from you today, I've learned two new pronunciations from an expert. I've always called it candida, and I've always called it fungi. So, two new pronunciations. Thank you. Candida and fungi. Wanted to ask you about particulate matter in the air. I mean, I think, you know, asthma is on the rise in our country, certainly in our area. And we kind of look at it as, just a decreased air quality overall and additional particulates. So it seems to me very hard to discern. Anytime I have anything respiratory, I think it's this sort of new, I call it exercise-induced asthma that I have. But are some people mistaking asthma or valley fever for asthma?
You know, I think that a lot of these respiratory diseases and the disease sort of complexes can blend together and symptoms can be similar. We certainly know that molds are allergens to some people. And in fact, I think there's been good evidence to suggest that some of the asthma symptoms that people have might be caused by aspergillus, maybe a small percent. There's been some evidence to suggest that if you treat some people with asthma with an antifungal medicine against aspergillus, that they get better and that they have less recurrences. But I think asthma is a complex issue, as you just said, and people who have it and have allergic reactions to something in their lung. It's a wide variety of different particulates and different things that they're reacting to. Mold probably play a role in that in some small way. You know, it's a fascinating area, and we don't really know. Certainly, when you have something like Valley Fever, where you're developing more of a flu-like illness, and more of a fever, more of something that feels more like, you know, an upper respiratory infection, a cold, that's going to be different than what you would have if you were having more of an exercise-induced asthma attack or something like you're talking about.
Dr. Chiller, over the years as a mycologist, you've learned a lot of things about fungi. And what have you learned that has most surprised you? What, like, really knocked you down and said, wow, that's amazing?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm surprised by fungi every day, I have to say, John. You know, we keep seeing new kids on the block. We keep seeing new fungi emerge and cause infections. And these are not, these again are opportunistic fungi. So they tend to cause infections in people that are severely immunocompromised or have been in hospitals. And so I'm not surprised by seeing some new name that I've never recognized before that was probably an environmental plant fungi and now is causing an infection in humans. So I always tell people, don't be surprised, you know, don't rule it out as an infection, even if it's never been, having been causing an infection before in a human, until we really study it and understand. And then I would say a couple other things that have been recently that have been very fascinating and troubling. I'm sure both of you'd heard about a large outbreak we had of a fungal disease that was caused by a contaminated steroid product that was being injected mainly into people's epidural space, so into their spines for back pain, and this caused fungal meningitis and death.
Right.
A number of people around the U.S. And certainly that was the first time I had seen such a widespread contaminated event and a fungal disease caused by an organism called Exerohilum that we had never seen cause meningitis before. So it caused us to really have to figure out and how we're going to treat something that never existed. And then the other thing that was fascinating, excuse me, the other thing that was fascinating to me was the fact that after the tornadoes in Joplin, we had a cluster of fungal infections causing wound injuries. I mean, in other words, wounds that had been infected with fungus from the tornado. So some way in which the projectiles that were flying around after a tornado hit lodged fungi into people's wounds or skin and then ultimately caused a fungal infection. We had not seen that before.
Mm. Yeah. So the second part of the question is, you have a lot of questions. What one question would you like to have answered?
Oh, wow, that's a...
You only get one.
I know.
It's got to be
only
good.
Give me one.
It's got to be
a
good
no
one,
way.
Too,
I've
Dr.
got a
Chiller.
List of 100 here.
Okay.
You know, fungi, the whole field, the whole kingdom of fungus, as we say, is got more unanswered questions than answered, for sure. I mean, I think we here at the CDC are concerned about increasing numbers of infections, both in mold and in Valley Fever, for example. And, you know, we want to know how to prevent these infections or prevent them from becoming severe. I mean, I think that big questions for me is how we can get people to be more immune and to resist these diseases using vaccines, using drugs, using biologics that we have available to us or maybe not available yet. And so I'm all about prevention, and that's what we're here at the CDC to try to understand and do. So my big question really would be, I mean, it's a big overriding question, is how can I prevent these infections from either occurring or prevent them from being severe?
Mm. Yeah, and that is all very interesting. Prevent something that you don't even know exists yet. So
exactly.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you, we've talked about Valley Fever, but we haven't really talked about its occurrence in Utah. What do you know about Utah? I mean, we're a desert.
Yeah, you guys are definitely desert. And, you know, I think what's important to point out about valley fever is that the endemic maps, we call these endemic diseases, but think of that as sort of a geographic disease. We know some diseases occur in geographic areas, and valley fever is one of those. And the maps that we have were done in the 1950s. And so we're going on half a century old, I mean more than half a century old, that of what our understanding is of where valley fever exists. We know now recently that is, these maps are old and need to be rethought. We knew back, as you all know, there was an outbreak, a small outbreak, a cluster reported in northeast Utah, Dinosaur National Park, and I think in 2001 or so, mm-hmm. Where valley fever was, that's a few hundred miles north of where it had been reported for years in essentially the southwest corner of Utah, which we knew was a part of the endemic area back in the old, and from the old maps done in the 50s. So here was a new foci, and we studied and tried to understand why. Is it because the soil was different? There were theories about it because it was shaded behind rocks. And as you know, this was part of an archaeological dig, and so recommendations were made about if you're digging in soils, you should use mast and you should try to wet the soil down. You know, it's incredibly challenging to figure out a way in which you, if you're working in those environments, to not breathe in a spore, because these spores exist and they're everywhere. And so even the best precautions, using masks, wetting soil, trying not to work in when it's, you know, when it's super dry, are still incredibly challenging to do and to actually really prevent disease. So we know that again, these endemic areas, these geographic areas, are probably different than our maps from the 50s. And so we need to understand better where it is in Utah, for example. I mean, we know it's there, but is it beyond areas that we once thought? Certainly the identification recently of it in Washington State, in eastern Washington, makes us think that the current in endemic area is probably much larger than we have recorded from the 50s.
Right. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, because I think some of our listeners are probably wondering this very thing. We think a lot about hantavirus when we think about kicking dust up, especially in dry areas. If I were to have, cleaned out an old garage or a barn or something, and I suddenly felt something in my lungs, I would think I had contracted hantavirus. So does it present similarly? Do you know?
You know, hanta would probably present a little more severe than valley fever. Valley fever tends to start with aches and pains, fatigue. You can have sort of a mild cough and a flu-like illness. Hanta, as you know, is more of a respiratory, and it gets pretty severe quickly. So it doesn't mean that at the beginning many of these infections can look a little alike. And certainly in your area, if you were doing those kinds of activities, I'd be concerned about hantavirus as well.
Okay, interesting. Well, it's really a fascinating area of research. Must be a very interesting job you have there at the CDC.
And absolutely.
Dr. Tom Chiller of the CDC, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. You have a great day.
You too. Bye now.
Bye.
And again, Dr. Tom Chiller, the Center for Disease Control. And John Wells, I just want to compliment you on how well you said that really long name that means valley fever.
I was up all night
practicing. Good. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about intuition, premonition, and hunches, and what they mean. Stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time Instacare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza Instacare. 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. If you were a scientist in the Expeditionary Maneuver Warfare and Combating Terrorism Department of the U.S. Navy, what kind of stuff would you be studying? Well, the part that's not secret is a fascinating function of the human mind. It's the part that makes us have a hunch, intuition, maybe premonition. Our next guest, Dr. Peter Squire, is the Program Officer for Human Performance, Training, and Education for the ONR, Office of Naval Research. And he studies what gives rise to the questions about how to harness your gut instinct. Can it be modeled? Can it be taught? Can it be improved? Dr. Squire, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, John. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Well, this is just a fascinating topic. I guess we'll start with what you all have just commissioned. In February, you had a meeting, and you brought together representatives from ONR, but also outside military service, industry, university, laboratories, on a four-year basic research program to, in fact, study all of this.
Yep, that's correct. We recently kicked off this basic research challenge initiative at the Office of Naval Research, looking at intuition and really the connection between implicit learning and how that may be used to enhance intuition. That's because, you know, the Marine Corps and our services, you know, have a traditional paradigm for education that we've used for the past, decade or so, many years, and we're trying to look at new training and education techniques that could be, you know, critical on the battlefield.
Yes, and my own personal experience is when I'm trying to wrestle through a challenge, is I find that if I'm more relaxed, it's better to come up with creative solutions. And I just can't imagine being in an environment where you have to make a decision. You're running down the road in a unsecure area in a Humvee. A child steps in front of the road. Is it some kind of ploy with a bomb in the road? Is there, you know, you've got to make these split second decisions, and I just can't imagine in the field of battle. Having to go through that because it's such a stressful environment.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's part of what the motivation and impetus was for this work, is that we were hearing anecdotally, you know, stories from warfighters coming back, you know, saying that they had, you know, this premonition, that they had a gut sense, right, the spidey sense, you know, hair standing on their back of their neck, that, you know, they were in this situation, it just didn't feel right, right? And that led them to, you know, detect potentially, you know, some threat before, you know, any harm was done. So we know that, you know, hearing that anecdotally, it gives us some idea that something like that, the intuition is going on. So then the next question is, well, really, how do we study that, you know, scientifically and break down the components so we can better understand it? And really then use that information, that understanding, to develop better training systems to really be able to enhance, you know, what they're doing then on that field, so that, you know, maybe it's not always the case that intuition was right. Well, really, what do we do to make sure that we can make that as effective as possible so that they can see those threats, you know, before any harm happens?
And for those sailors and Marines that shared the anecdotal stories and they were correct in their spiny sixth sense, did they all have a tremendous amount of experience, or were some of them just intuitive?
So that gets at kind of the heart of what we're looking at, that we know that these experiences play a role in the decision. You know, it's always been sort of the common convention that you need, like, say, 10,000 hours, that you need to build, you know, a whole huge mass of experience to be able to see some of that. But we're really looking at, well, how is that connection initially made through the implicit learning, through those gathering the information from the environment to really guide intuition? What are the critical features? That's not really well known to be able to enhance intuition. So we're diving into that. But what we do know is that research has shown that there's two different methods by which those decisions are done, this analytical as well as intuitive process. And we're focused really on enhancing and harnessing that intuitive process, that it's rapid, unconscious, that happens, you know, very quickly, but that's been built on, you know, those experiences and exposing to an environment where you're sensing all of these cues and information coming in, but you're not really always consciously aware of how that's impacting your perception. It's just each time that you see that environment and it's changing, you start picking up on the cues and differences that may occur over time. So those statistical, you know, those patterns, those regularities just start forming over time. So what are the questions of how you learn from those environments, that implicit learning? How does that then drive, right, or give rise to the intuition that you may have or experience?
Oh, it's fascinating. Well, Dr. Squire, I'm wondering, I've run into a couple people in my life who use their intuition, you know, hourly and trust it very much. However, it's false intuition. And I'm wondering if there are certain personality types that you've been able to pinpoint that either have false intuition or have really, you know, dead on intuition or premonition.
So I haven't run across anybody that, you know, has 100% sort of correct intuition. There was, again, anecdotal stories about those hunters, you know, going out, being able to detect IDDs, which people may have the best individual sort of differences, you know, to make those determinations. But there haven't really been good studies to show or validate that, you know, some individuals just from the get-go have a better a sense or intuition per se than others. It's really just, as I was stating, the collection of kind of the environment, that exposure, and those statistical kind of those regularities informing over time that really lend itself to enhancing your chance for having a greater intuition and it being correct than you know being incorrect or as you were saying false. It's really what we're driving at here is to understand it and study those conditions so that we can develop, you know, really the information that helps us know how through implicit, you know, learning, how do we really, what are the real factors that influence, you know, whether or not somebody's intuition is going to be valuable, perhaps, or really going to be harmful, potentially.
Well, I'm wondering if there are a variety of conditions around that surround how we've perhaps either sharpened our intuition or deadened it, you know, depending upon what type of, you know, if we live in the city or if we live in the country, if we are, you know, if we like the sport of hunting or whatever you call that, I don't know if it's a sport or not, or if, you know, if we ever rely on it or not. I mean, and this gives way to the question about whether or not you can train it, I suppose.
So that the first, right now, I wouldn't say we're training it in the sense within formula, you know, formal curriculums. We do a lot of experiential, you know, training and learning, but it's not formalized as it relates to connecting implicit learning to intuition. That's what we're trying to do with this program, is understand those basic, you know, tenets of the research, because if we understand those mechanisms for how implicit learning drives intuition, we can then take those core aspects and put them into a training curriculum. But right now, today, that doesn't exist because we don't really have a good understanding of how implicit learning drives or enhances intuition. That's really what this effort is going after, just to see if we can even, like I said, deconstruct and figure out what the key components are to make those two connections between implicit learning and intuition.
Historically, on our naval vessels, on our ships, our sailors follow orders, and They're told exactly what to do, and they you know, it's ship shape. I mean, you know, it's very organized. Is this a departure, or are we moving towards giving people more latitude? Does this have anything to do with that?
No, I mean, the chain of command is always going to be important. Again, what we're studying through this basic research is really trying to understand. So, you know, say a sailor on a ship, you know, sitting at a screen, and he sees, information continually to pass about different threats, you know, surface vessels or aircraft that may be flying around, and he has to make determinations of whether or not they may be hostile. So he just sees that over days and days and days and starts building kind of those regularities of what are, you know, what do things that are kind of normal look like as they move through that, you know, space, and which ones, if something deviates from that, you know, normal kind of pattern that he's seen, give rise to what may be a hostile threat. That's what we're going after, just to try to really enhance that warfighter's sense and capabilities by understanding, you know, what is it about as he's sitting there looking at this screen is really building that connection of implicit learning, that when something does happen and it's, you know, a different, that he's able to make that connection and detect it and trigger that, you know, intuition, that, you know, spider sense to really go off. What are those factors, both from, you know, cognitive and going on in the brain, what are those things that give rise to that?
Hmm. The collaboration that you all have in this four-year study with people from university, from research outside of industry outside of the ONR, is that something that commonly happens, or is ONR more compartmentalized?
Well, ONR, we are a research funding organization. We look for the best and the brightest across the world. And what we do then is we take research dollars and go out and apply that to problems that are relevant for the naval enterprise to address warfighter needs and requirements. And we're looking for industry, university, you know, government labs to bring forth, and we're looking for the best and brightest ideas to really go after that. So in this case, we put out a solicitation relative to what the needs were for our understanding of this basic research, and we got back a lot of submissions from some of the best thinkers in the world looking at this problem to say, here's how I would go about tackling it. And we reviewed those and, you know, selected some top-notch people, those at industry. There's an industry component with Mess Solutions. It's a DSCI company. And then we also have several universities, Northwestern University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and then some other industry partners, Charles River Analytics, as well as the Defense Group, Inc. So it's a pretty good collection, both of industry and university, going together to try to address this problem, because it has implications, obviously, not only for our military, but also in commercial arenas like firefighters, police, and others.
You know, what's fascinating, sort of a central theme that runs on Cool Science Radio and a lot of the conversations we have with people from nanotechnology, from brain imaging, animal-insect studies, astrophysics, all sorts of different topics, is the tremendous amount of collaboration that's going on right now, where they used to be more contained in their groups, and now all these different disciplines are collaborating together, and it's fascinating the results that they're able to come up with.
Yeah, no, I think we're really moving towards an if we haven't already gotten there, an interdisciplinary world. I mean, the problems and challenges that we face today are, you know, are complex in nature, and both in terms of understanding them at the fundamental, you know, doing basic lab-based research, and then also in our interest, you know, eventually trying to get something to the warfighter, you need kind of a balance between those interdisciplinary approaches, but both, you know, lab-based as well as scientifically based, either it's, you know, in some sense, modeling and simulation aspects that are being done, or just traditional, you know, psychological studies where you have people come into the into a lab and give them some different types of stimulus to be looking at and collecting data from that. So this, it really represents a very good holistic way to be going after some of the problems that face our warfighters today.
Yes, it's funny. It's holistic, but at the same time, it's kind of ironic and contradictory in a way to be blending hard science with, you know, the metaphysical or the esoteric. And I'm wondering, Dr. Squire, what is your educational background?
So I have a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science and a Master's and PhD in Human Factors and Applied Cognition. My main interest was, in understanding the brain, and the brain is not just a single discipline. It's, you know, made up of, neuroscience, chemistry, biology, psychology. So, it really wraps itself around being interdisciplinary, and that was my primary interest. I'm fascinated the way with we think and work and how we interact with the systems that we use on a daily basis. And that's really what I try to get at with my sort of academic background.
Yeah. So I'm wondering how many times a day you hear someone say, well, the scientist in me, can't agree with that or can't accept that. Are you still hearing that?
I don't hear that too often. Most of the time, I don't hear that too often.
Well, that's good.
We are talking with Dr. Peter Squire, Program Officer for Human Performance Training and Education for ONR, Office of Naval Research. Dr. Squire, I wanted to ask you, this four-year study to help our sailors and our Marines, are we also looking maybe to help our non-human devices like possibly autonomous drones in their decision-making?
That's not... a direct focus, but because the work we're doing under this effort is basic research, it's very broad in its nature. So we're looking at the critical underpinnings of connection between implicit learning and intuition as it relates to, you know, humans. Particularly, we were thinking, our military personnel that are out in the battlefield. But obviously, as we understand those connections and underpinnings and mechanisms, there may be, interesting tidbits that come out of that is useful and can be applied to the areas of robotics and drones for the way that they go about performing their operations.
Sure. 5 years ago, a Predator drone had a couple of cameras and collected so much data. Today, a Predator drone has like 65 cameras and can take a look at an entire battlefield and start not only collecting data, but can start making decisions and assumptions and things like that. And it's actually a little scary.
But, yeah, I can't comment on that. I don't know how far we've come along with regards to the Predators, and I don't know that. I don't think they're out there on the battlefield making decisions quite yet. There's still the need for the human in the loop for most operations.
Yeah, there's also a lot of stuff that we're not aware of. So, you never know what's going on out there. But this has been a fascinating conversation, and we'd like to invite you back on the show when you start getting some thoughts from this study and talk to you about it further.
Oh, happy to come back. This has been great, fantastic. And we're certainly eager as we get underway, to start getting some results and start sharing it with, the scientific community and larger community in general about some of the great results that we'll be finding and implications for what people do in their daily lives.
Yeah. Lynn has one more quick question she'd like to ask you before we button up.
Dr. Squire, I've just been wondering, as you've been speaking this whole time, give us, if you can think of one off the top of your head, give us some great anecdote about someone employing their intuition.
The most common one that's typically discussed or used is about a firefighter. So somebody that, you know, a firefighter that's had years of experience who shows up, it could be like a chief, somebody that's, you know, more senior shows up at a scene, you know, there's a blazing fire going on in front of them. And they, you know, show up and they just see, look across and survey, that fire, and they see something that doesn't seem, you know, right. They're not entirely certain. It's not conscious to them, but it just, you know, again, that's that tingling. It just doesn't feel. It's a gut hunch that something isn't correct. So they pull out, you know, all the firefighters, the men that are trying to battle the blaze. And, you know, moments after them pulling out, the building collapses.
Mm.
So that's kind of the classic example where you see something where somebody's had, again, a great deal of expertise and experience, where they just notice something that is not, doesn't match with what they typically experience or see, but they can't, you know, they can't articulate that because it's unconscious, right? It's not something that's directly at their awareness that they can point to, this is the reason that I pulled them out. It's more of, it was, you know, it was a gut. I just felt like it didn't, you know, it wasn't right. So those, that is where the intuition comes into play. And the importance, because again, yeah, if used successfully, it can save lives in important situations.
Dr. Peter Squire, thank you again for joining us, and we'd love to have another conversation with you in the future.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, John.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
Well, you're listening to Cool Science Radio. We shall return after these messages. Cool Science Radio only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we're looking at the real world of the chef, and I'm not talking about being in front of a TV camera. To be a chef, you need to be running a kitchen, and you need to love to cook. The Spotted Pig's April Bloomfield joins us. That's this week on The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by the River Horse on Main.
You're listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Well, John, you know, I have this friend who does the online dating thing, and he has said to me before that sometimes, you know, you show up at the coffee joint or whatever, and this is terrible, but you see the person you're supposed to meet, and suddenly you wish you had one of those invisibility cloaks, like, you know, on Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, our cool story today, my friend may want to be like a cuttlefish.
Ooh.
That's cuttle, not cuddle like, you know, spoons.
Okay.
Tell us about the cuttlefish.
Well, yeah, it's just a fascinating fish. There are a number of animals in our world that have incredible camouflage. But what happens is when they move away from their environment, their camouflage is shot because they no longer blend in. A cuttlefish has this uncanny ability to be able to change pattern, color, and texture in milliseconds. And a predator could be chasing it like a shark. And all of us, and a cuttlefish, by the way, is part of the squid family. And all of a sudden, this thing will disappear. Harry Potter.
Invisibility cloak. So changing texture, I mean, you know, it can't transform into a rock or anything, but you know, texture, maybe we're talking, it goes from soft to fairly hard, something like that.
Yeah, the how porous the skin is, or a jagged type look to it. But I actually took a look at some pictures of a cuttlefish swimming from one background to another, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, that's good stuff. All right. Well, we want to thank our guests today, Dr. Tom Chiller from the CDC and Dr. Peter Squire of the Office of Naval Research. Interesting topics indeed. Also want to thank our underwriters.
Oh, yeah. Peak Art and Frame, San Francisco Design, Prudential, Utah Real Estate, and our producer extraordinaire, Beth Fratkin. And also, join us tomorrow for Fun Friday at 9 a.m. They always have good stuff going on.
That's right. You've been listening to Cool Science Radio.